snow brings the Northeast to a halt, what does that say about our infrastructure?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, December 27th. Coming up, before you throw away your Christmas tree and crumpled up wrapping paper, we've got some tips for a green Christmas. Also, we'll take a listen to one of the worst TV commercials of the year. It is astoundingly annoying. But first, we're all supposed to be heading back to work today after the holiday weekend, but if you're anywhere from North Carolina to Maine, good luck. That huge snowstorm has halted planes, trains, and automobiles on one of the busiest travel days of the year. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is with us this morning on the Blizzard Beat. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Jeremy.
So tell us first about the impact on transportation in the Northeast so far.
Well, the New York airports have all been closed. At least 2,000 flights canceled on the East Coast. Amtrak stopped service from New York all the way to Maine. It's just a mess.
And it's a mess, Mitchell, that we hear about, it seems, at least a couple of times every year. Is there anything that ought to be done infrastructure-wise to make this kind of blizzard less of a travel impediment?
Well, in terms of air traffic, Jeremy, really there are two issues here: capacity and cost. You know, many of these big airports are already over capacity. At JFK, you have 350 flights a day. That's one every few minutes. Then you add extreme weather. Here's London-based airline analyst Larry Price.
We do not have any contingency or resilience in the system to allow us to deal with events such as very, very heavy snowstorms. What do we invest in for these one-off events in order to maintain the integrity of the system? And inevitably, there's a balance to be struck.
So there's a balance to be struck, Mitchell. How are the airports doing in terms of striking that balance today?
Well, you know, it's a good question. After 9/11, airports basically stopped spending on almost anything except security. Since then, though, some of them have kind of gotten religion on snow removal because the cost of not doing it fast and effectively is so high. So Denver International, for instance, which sure gets plenty of snow, they've spent millions on new plows, new snow melters. They now have elaborate plans for which runways are crucial to keep open and which to abandon to the snow.
All right, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, to Washington now, where Republicans are about to take control of the House of Representatives, and when they do, they'll change the budget rules. Democrats had a pay-as-you-go requirement. All new spending and all tax cuts had to be paid for. Well, House Republicans plan to adopt what they call cut-as-you-go. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains.
Under cut-as-you-go, new spending still has to be paid for, but not tax cuts. Stanley Collender at Corvus Communications says Republicans are spelling out their priorities.
We want to cut spending to reduce the deficit, not increase taxes, and we want to be able to cut taxes as much as we want without worrying about the deficit.
Some Republicans argue tax cuts bring more economic activity, which generates more taxable income and more government revenue.
Clearly, this is nonsense.
Bruce Bartlett is a former economist at the Treasury Department.
We've seen very substantial increases in the deficit under Republican administrations.
The other goal of the cut-as-you-go rule, says Bartlett, is to trim the size of government.
The theory that Republicans have been operating under since the late 1970s is something called starve the beast.
The thinking goes the fewer taxes paid, the less government has to spend. But Bartlett says tax cuts just result in more government borrowing. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
After 70 years of getting into and out of trouble, comic strip character and ace reporter Brenda Starr is preparing to leave the comics page for good. Brenda files her final story next Sunday. From Chicago Public Radio, Tony Arnold reports now on what her departure means for the business of newspaper comic strips.
When she was created in 1940, Brenda Starr was groundbreaking. She was female, sassy, and had a love life.
In Brenda's heyday, she was everywhere. She was huge. She was Lady Gaga.
Mary Schmeek took over writing the Brenda Starr strip in 1985, but she says Starr and similar strips have now had their day.
I think it is really difficult in a modern newspaper to sustain a storyline strip, a soap opera strip, where you have to follow it every day.
Lucy Shelton Caswell is the curator of a cartoon museum affiliated with Ohio State University. She says newspaper editors should be using their comics pages to entice young readers.
If you only have comic strips that are X years old that don't appeal to young readers, then you shouldn't be surprised that they don't buy your paper or read you online.
And the editors had to find those future buyers, or their papers may go the way of Brenda Starr. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold for Marketplace.
The website The Daily Beast has come up with a list of the worst TV commercials of the year, and I'm not surprised this one made the list.
Christmas fight for three. Value, menu, get a bundle of hearts up, woohoo, or two items from the choose two menu, over a foot of flavor with a toasty torpedo for just $4.
Quiznos thinks that'll boost profitability. Might be time to rethink Quiznos. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, December 27th. I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. Well, that blizzard has helped oil prices reach a two-year high. Cold weather is forcing people to use energy to heat their homes, which drives up prices. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, there are other forces sending the price of oil skyward.
Ministers from the OPEC oil cartel met in Cairo this weekend, and they sent a pretty clear message to the market. They do not intend to pump more oil to increase supply and bring down the price of crude. The Kuwaiti oil minister said he thought $100 a barrel wouldn't harm the global economy. Nick McGregor is an oil analyst with stockbrokers Redmayne Bentley. He believes the oil price is headed towards $100 and beyond because of the surprising strength of the global recovery.
That's pushed up consumption, which has risen by about 1.5 million barrels a day through 2010, and that ultimately has had an upward push on crude prices as people start looking forward to a world recovering from recession.
The rising price of oil is pushing up the cost of goods and services around the world, and that is causing such concern in China that this weekend the Chinese raised their interest rates to slow down the rampant growth in their economy. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Now for another take on the high price of oil, let's bring in Julia Coronado. She's chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us now from snowy New York. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning.
So first, the good. Higher oil prices, I guess that means a stronger demand for oil, which means maybe a stronger economic recovery. Am I right?
Certainly, that's one of the things driving oil prices higher are indications that the American economy and other places around the world, economic activity is picking up, and that means stronger energy demand and higher oil prices.
So that's the good side of things. But obviously, we saw some very high oil prices, much higher than we're seeing right now, right before the economy collapsed back in 2008. How much risk is there that high prices in oil, which then lead to high prices at the gas pump, could stifle the economic recovery?
Well, that's exactly right. Right now, the recovery still is at a fairly fragile state. And, of course, higher oil prices mean that consumers have to spend more of their money on gasoline and less money on other goods and services that could actually stimulate the economy. So we're at a delicate stage, and it could be that these higher oil prices act as a tax and undo some of the stimulative effect of, for example, the fiscal package that was passed recently that's trying to put more money in consumers' pockets. The higher gas prices will tax some of that benefit away.
Now, Julia, we're around $94 a barrel right now. Is there a good balance? Is there a good price that we should be looking for oil?
Well, right now, I'd say, you know, there is certainly going to be somewhat of a drag on consumer spending from the higher oil prices, but it's not necessarily devastating if we continue to see better economic signs. In particular, we need to see stronger job creation. If job creation really picks up and we see income growth picking up, then, of course, that can more than offset higher gasoline prices. So that's what we're going to be looking for in the next few weeks.
All right, Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks so much and enjoy the snow.
I will. Thank you.
To Russia now, where the oil tycoon who used to be the country's richest man will remain behind bars. A judge this morning found Mikhail Khodorkovsky guilty of stealing millions of tons of oil. Needless to say, this verdict isn't likely to improve the business climate in Russia. Reporter Peter Van Dyke joins us now from Moscow with more. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what exactly did the judge say?
Well, we won't get the full verdict for several days, but we know now that the judge has found Khodorkovsky guilty of embezzlement and money laundering. He said Khodorkovsky stole the money from his company, Yukos, for his own personal gain. The judge has not issued the sentence yet, but prosecutors want Khodorkovsky to stay behind bars until 2017.
And Peter, remind us who this guy is.
He's one of the so-called oligarchs who became billionaires after Russia's natural resources were privatized cheaply at the end of communism. When he was arrested in 2003, he was seen as a political rival to then-President Vladimir Putin. Supporters say it was his political activity that landed him in jail. The Kremlin denies that.
Peter, what does this decision say about the broader economic and business atmosphere there in Russia?
I asked Chris Weifer of Uralsib Investment Bank that very question. He says the guilty verdict was expected and will change very little.
It's not a surprise from an investor's point of view. It's what they had assumed. I think those investors that had not been engaged in Russia, but you know, were looking for positive signs of change, then I guess maybe they'll be disappointed.
And for the most part, Western firms will continue to do business in Russia, as will Western governments.
All right, Peter Van Dyke in Moscow, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, December 27th. I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Union leaders in Wisconsin are worried that companies are taking advantage of the down economy and forcing blue-collar workers to accept lower wages permanently. Over the past year or so, a few major companies have threatened to relocate jobs outside Wisconsin if workers don't agree to major concessions. From WUWM in Milwaukee, LaToya Dennis has more.
Kohler, Wisconsin is a small village that's home to a big company that bears its name. Kohler makes kitchen and bathroom fixtures. This year, it became the third Wisconsin company to threaten to leave if union members didn't rework their contract. In the end, Kohler employees accepted a deal to freeze their wages and pay more for health care. Employees also agreed to a two-tier pay system in which new employees cannot join the union and will make 35% less than their counterparts.
Concessions are unwarranted, unreasonable, and overly severe.
Dave Boucher is an officer with the local union representing Kohler employees.
The question was asked earlier if our members will be able to survive with this contract. Yes, our members can, at least the majority of them, but most certainly working as a temporary member of the workforce at 65% of the wage with no benefits, those people are going to have a very hard time supporting a family.
Within the past year and a half, employees at both Mercury Marine and Harley-Davidson agreed to similar deals. Paul Kardish is Kohler's senior staff attorney for labor relations. He says it all boils down to reducing pay and benefits to keep the company afloat.
We're paying what we think are appropriate wages, and what we're trying to do again is just sort of reset the wage structure so that it can ensure viability of operations here in Sheboygan County.
Kardish says employee wages had simply become too high for the company in comparison with other jobs in the area. Still, for mayors in cities where people are taking wage cuts, these concessions are tough. Tom Barrett is the mayor of Milwaukee, where Harley-Davidson is based.
They're such well-respected companies. You want them to thrive, but you also want the people who work there to have jobs where they can support their families. And that's where things get tougher with the concessions that have been made.
Barrett says right now, employers have the upper hand. In Milwaukee, I'm LaToya Dennis for Marketplace.
Well, another Christmas is over, so what are you going to do with that tree and all that crumpled up wrapping paper? Well, before you chuck it all, we've asked our sustainability reporter, Adrian Hill, to join us for some holiday recycling tips. Morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So all that wrapping paper, can I just throw that in the recycling bin?
Probably. Most places will take plain wrapping paper, but you might want to double check. The foil paper, the shiny, glittery stuff can be a no-go. If you have to toss it, if you didn't rip it all to shreds, you could use it again next year. Or you could get super crafty and make gift tags or fluff for bags, right? Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm going to be that crafty. crafty, Adrian, but I get where you're coming from. What about the Christmas tree? What's the best way to get rid of that?
Well, lots of cities and communities have programs where you can bring your tree or they'll pick it up and turn it into mulch. Some parts of the country get a bit more creative. In Louisiana, they use old Christmas trees for coast restoration around the marshes. And if you're in a rural area and have a fish pond, Missouri recommends putting the tree right in the pond. Fish love the little nooks and crannies a tree can provide. But don't toss it in the garbage. Trees can take up a lot of space in landfills, and in some places it's illegal.
All right, so what else you got? What are the other tips to keep this Christmas nice and green?
Well, if you got new shiny gadgets and electronics, don't just toss the old ones. Look for a place that might recycle it, that will take e-waste and repurpose some of the resources that went into making it. Best Buy is now recycling most electronics, no matter where you bought them.
All right, so it's all about repurposing, recycling. What about re-gifting, Adrian? Is that a good thing to do?
It's a great thing to do. Re-gifting is recycling, really. I met a guy named Edward Acosta who said if his kids get two of the same thing, one of those might wind up re-gifted.
My kids, they get some duplicate of the toys and stuff. So what I do is some of them I return it, and some of them my wife said to keep it and re-gifted it to somebody who had a birthday or something.
He says it's worked out pretty well. But, Jeremy, the trick is to keep track of the person who gave you those reindeer socks so you don't actually give them back to that same person.
That could be embarrassing. Yeah. Marketplace's Adrian Hill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And finally, while we're on the subject of a green Christmas, listen to this. In the Netherlands, they've been getting some wintry weather just like us, and the police there are scanning for rooftops that are not covered with snow. That, they say, is because a clear roof is a good indication that hot attic lights are on, as in lights for the illegal growing of a certain plant. We're not talking about mistletoe, I don't think. And did somebody check what Frosty's smoking in his corncob pipe? I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.